I'd like to call the meeting to order of local government. We're still one short of a quorum, but we'll start hearing the bill, and hopefully we get quorum, we can proceed from there. Representative Sturgis, Majority Leader, welcome to the committee, and House File 17, if you'd like to give an explanation of the bill, and go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, thanks for having me before you today. House File 17 deals with the Central Iron Range Sanitary Sewer District. This district was created back in 2003 and adjusted to 2010. There were some clerical errors, though, where it requires local approvals through resolution. What happened was the district was never, I believe, originally approved, though the amendments to the district were approved. All this clerical error happened, and they tried to fix it in 2008. One resolution from one of the communities was submitted to the Secretary of State's office by a day late, and the district ceased to exist by law. This district now would be reformed with the governing board. The only change from previous years is that it's voluntary and permissive language, that the communities involved may opt to join or not, and do so by resolution and or local referendums. So it really gives local control to the communities.
Thank you, Representative Sturgis. Now we have a quorum. Call official call to order. I will move House File 17 to be passed and recommended for passage, and move to the Government Operations Committee. Do you have any testifiers?
No, I do not, Mr. Chair. Though I do have resolutions of support from the communities, if the committee would
like. Okay. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to speak for or against this bill? Questions from the committee? Representative Business.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sturgis, is it my understanding that the language that's before us is identical to previous language that the municipalities have already approved? All of them have approved, only one was one day late, is that correct?
Representative Sturgis.
Sure, so this can there's a new language, so the communities have approved a new language that adds the potential for communities to have referenda to join. That was something they felt important to change from the previous legislation. So there's some minor changes like that, but all changes have come from the communities, not from myself.
Representative Fiston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any more questions for the representative? If not, anybody in the audience? I'll renew my motion that House File 17 be approved and recommended to pass and move to Government Operations Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'll get out of the room to maybe free up some space for all the others who are waiting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hopefully you'll save some of the libations at the Ranger Party for us so we can get there.
As soon as you can.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Sterling, you want to take the chair? Next bill down the agenda is House File 1849.
Representative Nelson, would you care to move your bill?
Yeah, I'd like to move House File 1849 to be recommended to pass and move to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations.
So moved, and I do understand there's an author's amendment?
Yeah, I have a DE amendment, a DE1 amendment to have in your packet, and I'd like to move that amendment first.
Okay, great. So moved.
And then I have an amendment to the DE amendment I want to incorporate in that. This is the 1849A2 amendment to be in your packet.
Okay, let's see what that is.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for proper form, I think we should vote on the DE1 amendment, and then we'll vote to amend what's before us.
Okay, well, Representative Biscuits, To your point, but we'll do the incorporation of the this H1849-D2 into the bill that so the D2. D1, okay. The D1
amendment. Just an explanation. The A2 amendment is to leave Section 3 of the DE, Section 3 of the DE2 amendment, of the DE1 amendment, excuse me.
Okay. So it's incorporated. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment?
As amendment?
Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Amendment adopted. Motion prevails. Okay, go ahead and represent Alston Mosquera. Information on the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
And what the my notes here so I can read from them. What the DE1 amendment does is put this in line with Senate language and also puts in some of the language that was passed previously in House File 1195, Representative Lanning Mandate Reduction Bill. We put his language that was in there that the Senate didn't have in theirs, but the DE1 amendment takes out language that they took out in the Senate and puts and cleans some of the stuff up. So I'll walk through the bill here. The first part of the bill, the effective dates for rules implementation. Again, that was part of Representative Lanning's bill, and what this does is modifies provisions related to the local government mandates about when rules go into effect, the dates that they go into effect, so the local governments don't have to change their rules outside of the normal time. Section 2 of the bill has to do with, it was part of Representative Lanning's bill, and it deals with best value method of contracting, and just takes the limitation that we took off earlier on that. The limit is to a number of projects they could do in the year, and that came from requests of the counties and the cities. Again, Section 3, we deleted from the bill, from the amendment. Section 4 has to do with abandonment of cemeteries that have been taken over by counties. And again, this was also Representative Lanning's bill, and it just provides language for cities to be, or counties being able to prohibit further burials in those. Section 5 is their annual report. And again, that was also in Representative Lanning's bill. Paul here. On the right one here. It's a label. Section 5. It increases the threshold from $5,000 to $1,000 to $10,000 on these annual reports. This is in the Senate provision. It's to match up with that. Section 6, again, is about compensation of fence viewers. Again, we have this discussion in Representative Lanning's bill. Again, this was in Representative Lanning's bill, 1195. Section 7, again, is the same provision on burial grounds that have been taken over. This is for township language. Again, this was also in House File 1195. Section 8 of the bill allows county commissioners in all counties except for Hennepin and Ramsey County to lower their salaries to deal with budget crises without having to wait for the next election. And that came out of some discussions. There was a bill Representative Doty had, and we included that in this bill, in this House file. Section 9 deals with small claims, that reporting the small claims, and it just raises the limit from 300 to 2,000. And this is provision about reporting those in the newspaper. And again, this was an earlier bill that we had, and that allowed us to do that. Go down the line. The courts to hire certain counties, gives counties the authority to set pay for county courts, auditors, and treasurers. Sets minimum salaries for populations less than 75,000, and sets a statutory schedule. Additionally, if there's a complicated appeal process for pay structure, and that for county courts stopped by the counties. And this again is in the Senate provisions of the bill. We're doing this to match up with the Senate. Section 11 of the bill, again, is for Hennepin County, allows them to increase their salary. And by authorization of the board, they can do it immediately, not have to wait until after the next election. You notice that Ramsey County is not included in either one of these provisions, but I was told that I asked that question, Ramsey County has the ability to do that already on their own because of the way they're chartered. Section 12 and 13. It eliminates the threshold for advertising the right one. Fumbling through here a little bit. Section 12, 11 is compensation. Section 12, again, set by the salary of the county auditor. Again, that's the same provision. That's what the county auditor, the earlier one was for county clerk. And section 13, Section 13 is for the county treasurer, and section 14 is for the county reporter. You know, I described that earlier about all the setting up a procedure for setting their salaries. Section 15, just take this as a part. Section 15 has to do with the county sheriff's expenses. Section 16 has to do with the county sheriff's sustainment with giving them counties of less than $75,000, but the county board can set their salaries. Section 17 of the bill is again having to do with rate reductions in salaries. This is for language for cities to allow them to be able to lower their salaries in times of shortfall without having to go through the next election. Section 18 of the bill. Section 19 of the bill and Section 20 of the bill deal with taking out a statute, the $50,000 maximum, it actually increases it to $100,000, but it does it by referencing Section 471.345 in statute. Before there was some confusion, and this is also Representative Landing's bill, there was some confusion back and forth. It was in two different sections of statute. This puts it all in one section of statute and refers it to that. Again, section 20 does the same thing. So bring those dollar figures except to section 471.345. Section 21 of the bill has to do with pay equity reporting. And again, that was in Representative Lanning's bill. And that has to do with pushing it to 5-year reporting cycle unless a county's government's been founded to be in violation of the pay equity provisions, and when it puts them on a 5-year, if they're complying with it and they've been in compliance, it puts them on a 5-year cycle of reporting for them.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lane.
Representative
Lane.
Thank you.
I'm wrong side of the table.
Just a correction there. That provision was in my original bill, and we took it out. Final version that went through committee before, so it wasn't in the final version.
I stand corrected. But is it Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, it is in the Senate version, that's why we did it in the National Senate.
Okay. Thank you. Section 22.
Section 22 of the just has an open Dakota County to provisions. Let me get back here. Allows an open exempts an open in Dakota County from certain elements of the Met Council's Comprehensive Planning Board. Ramsey and Hennepin County currently do at this point have this exemption, and these counties use a different process for that. Again, this is a Senate provision that's matching up with the Senate bill. And Section 23
eliminates the cap on booking fees for counties for when they're booking people into the prison, into the jails. And then Section 24 is the repealer. And again, that lines up with the Senate provisions. And I stand for questions.
Thank you. Do you have any testifiers as well with you?
If the counties are here, if they want to testify,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I believe starting with Section 12 on, there are a number of sections dealing with procedures by which county boards set salaries for various elected officials. One of the changes that we see here, Representative Nelson, is that we are now only imposing these procedures on counties of less than 75,000 in population. Representative Nelson, how many counties of the 87 are less than 75,000?
I think I'll call all the counties up here. I'm not sure, but I'll ask. Thank you.
Could you state your name for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Matthews of the Association of Minnesota Counties. I believe the vast majority of counties are under 75,000. And in reference to the section, Representative Biskins, what we're trying to do is just paint up some obsolete language. Right now, none of these elected officials are at this minimum salary, so we're trying to go in and just take some of that language out since it's no longer really relevant to our current practice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, as I read, and I'll just see, I'll start at the first one, page 6, line 1.8. This section not only puts in the minimum language, which I support, but it actually also gives a process for how the salary is set. When the change is that this process only affects counties of less than 75,000 in population, you effectively remove any procedures for counties that are more than 75,000. Do you understand what I'm saying? And am I correct in that reading? And if so, where then does the law spell out how these salaries are set for counties of more than 75,000?
Mr. Matthews?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I apologize. I'm not sure offhand where they would be covered in statute. I know that clearly they need to set the salaries each year as part of their process, but I'm not sure. Keith might have the answer yet.
Mr. Charlson, could you state your name and organization for the record, please?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that has some counties below the 75,000 population threshold. All the language is going to simply replacing the repeal cross-reference. So it's just maintaining the aspect of current law that you have to annually set the salary of those individuals who were previously subject to these minimum salary requirements. As a practical matter, every county sets the salary for all of its employees on an annual or a periodic basis. So it really has no practical effect, drafters were conservative in doing this section and maintain effectively the old cross reference to counties under 75,000.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then, Mr. Carlson, perhaps you can explain to me the cross reference concept because, again, I'm going to read this verbatim, all right? The old law said that the county board of each of the counties specified in subdivision 1. Is that the cross-reference, Mr. Carlson? Did subdivision 1 that I don't see on this legislation, was that the 75,000 threshold that you're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, if you go on page 15, section 24, you'll see the repealer of the cross-reference that is stricken. again, that's the minimum salary requirements in current law that have been by far and away exceeded in every practical application that exists out there right now. So since the cross-reference is being repealed, staff in drafting it then said this applies to counties under 75,000 that the repealed cross-reference also applies to.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not going to be ready for the point. The motion is to move this to the next committee of which I sit on, and I know that representative does want to get to an iron range party. but I still do remain concerned that I'm not quite sure that in making this change referencing subdivision 1A to only counties of less than 75,000, and the minimum piece is that's different. I'm glad we're taking out the floor. My concern is that in taking out the floor, we take out all of the procedures for counties above 75,000, because these procedures now are only ineffective for counties of less than 75,000.
Representative
Biskin, the exceptions in their entirety only apply to the 12 counties, but the subdivisions that are repealed talk about counties of the state with less than 75,000 inhabitants according to the 1960 federal census. So all of the procedures also, under current law, apply to these low population counties.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. First, I appreciate the just the work that I think has happened in the House this session, just the whole area of mandates. Representative Lanning and others have been working on that. Yeah, I'm just wondering if you could, maybe somebody from the counties might be the ones who could do this. Could you just laundry list a few of the mandates that this piece of legislation is going to give us some relief from, and is there any economic benefit that they're going to receive by being relieved of those mandates?
Mr. Matthews.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I'd be happy to give you the list of the ones that we're champions of. The first section having to do with the local implementation, that's one. The county cemeteries is another one. The construction fee report. The small claims publishing threshold. I remember what else is in here. And the pay equity and the booking fee are probably the bigger ones. And as far as the dollar amount, we haven't aggregated that. What we're really trying to do, as anyone who is a part of the process is probably well aware, we had a long list of mandates, both for Representative Lanning and for Representative Nelson, some of which were very high dollar items, some of which were smaller. I think the ones in this bill are on the smaller size, but they add up. And so what we're trying to do is just really stop with some of the busy work, and as we free up time, hopefully that can give us some more efficiently operating staff and hopefully reduce some costs and hopefully some less overtime down the road. But we don't have an exact dollar.
Mr. Chair, and one other question you referred to. It's the couple places in here you hit the issue of cemeteries, and I guess I'm just curious about that. A lot of these old cemeteries, people own plots, and I see that the legislation here says that cities could be, or counties, I think, could prohibit people from exercising burials. What happens if somebody actually owns some plots in those cemeteries? Are they going to be prohibited, or are they going to be reimbursed, or how would that work?
Mr. Chair, if I could, I think Ken Spillo from the townships is here, and they're far more experts at the cemetery issues, so I'll let him answer that one.
Mrs. Sulum, could you state your name and put your word for the records, please?
Mr. Chair, Ken Sulum with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And this is, we're covered under Section 7 of the same language. And Ms. Dyson and I actually did talk about this prior to the drafting of the Lanning's bill. But what we would advise is, with this language, is somebody can actually provide proof of ownership and title to the lot
they most likely would provide burial. But we have more often with these cemeteries, there are no records whatsoever, and people are just claiming or wanting to be pursuing burials without any proof of ownership. And this just makes it clear that we can set a policy, no, we're not going to expand when we have no records, because the vast majority are ones where the association that ran the cemetery in the past has been gone more than 10 years. Frequently, it's been many decades, and there's no surviving record holder, and so we just have no file to go on, and this would allow us discretion. But from a legal perspective, if somebody can actually show a true valid title, we'd probably advise they'd be allowed to use it or buy it back.
Okay, Representative Beard.
Thank you. Before Mr. Sulem gets away.
He is.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Sulem, in Section 6 of the bill, compensation for viewers, fence viewing. I'm just a city boy. Would you enlighten me as to what that means? And is that a job I can be qualified for and should probably see?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, fence viewing is a very common problem for town supervisors, and you are not the first to ask me. As a matter of fact, the person sitting to your immediate left, Aldo, inquired about this.
He was afraid to ask in public. Doesn't
matter. It usually what happens is you get a situation. I actually had three emails last week alone on it, where one parcel owner buys cattle, does not fence them in. They do what cows do, and they roam, and the neighboring provinces get these cows off my land. And one side or the other decides to put the fence. Well, under state law, the property owners are to divide the cost of that fence 50-50, and when there's a dispute as to the adequacy of the fence, or one side or the other does not do their job to put up the half, the town supervisors must go out, do a viewing, and then issue the orders. And previously they were capped at only being paid $50 for doing that, divided among all the supervisors over all the hearing. And so you basically were subsidizing private money disputes with tax dollars to the point which we're now saying, you get your money back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel better.
Mr. Chair, when I saw this language originally in Representative Lanny's bill, I had the same question. Being a city boy, didn't know what fence viewing was. And I am not capable, or I am not comparable to do it.
Thank you. Representative Taylor.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question for Mr. Snow on this issue. Who gets the bounty for a pocket gopher if they're discovered when the fence viewer is out? Is it the either landowner or is it the fence viewer?
Mr. Snow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, in order to collect the bounty, you actually have to be going chapters to go for a removal to see detail.
So it's the actual case.
The person who successfully captures the gopher and is going to dissect it, you have the money.
Any questions? Is there anyone in the audience to testify for or against the bill? Okay. Could you state your name for the audience, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bonnie Watkins, and I'm here today as an individual member of the Day Equity Coalition. Can you hear? Go ahead. We are very much opposed to this motion, and that's what the member is now, of the Day Equity Proposal, Section 21. I should explain that I was the state first Day Equity Coordinator in this project from 1984 when we passed this law in 1989. So my comments are based on quite a few years of experience with this wonderful law that has been working very, very well. Our major objection to having a city here is it really does not save any money and it does not really save the local governments any significant amount of time. The comment about stopping busy work, I will just show you. I asked the Department of, who enforces this law to give me a typical report of a city suburb. It happens to be the city of Daniel Heights. And as you can see, it is a two-page document. It is a very simple list of the, whatever it is, 20 job classes in the city and how much they're paid. And I really feel strongly, if you can't produce a list like this once every 3 years, I don't know how you could meet payroll in the first place if you don't know who's working for you and how much they're supposed to be paying. Obviously, this is not the entire pay equity program. This is a mechanism to make sure that pay equity continues to work. Now, I understand conceptually that we're saying, well, if you were good, you know, 3 years ago, then maybe you only have to do it every 5 years instead of every 3 years. And in fact, that really causes potentially a mountain of problems. Number one, there's a fair amount of turnover, particularly in some of these smaller cities. So you're going to have a new person who's going to have that much longer to not know how to do it, to need training, which comes back on the government to do that kind of training and explain how this is done. It's very, very simple, but it is vitally important that we keep those systems up to date. What we have seen over the many years this thing has been working so great in Minnesota is that if you keep it up, if you keep doing the study, you add in the new jobs, you stay on top of the situation, this is not going to be a problem. You're not going to have strikes and lawsuits and a lot of anybody on this. If you let things slide, if you let those inequities that are gender-based begin to bubble up again, and believe me, they do if you don't pay attention. It costs more, it causes more aggravation, and it's a major problem. The confusion is a major issue. My biggest concern also is that it will send a message that maybe inequities are okay for up to 5 years. You know, it's tough times, we have a recession. Maybe equal pay is not really a priority of the state of Minnesota anymore. And I don't think you all believe that, and I don't think you intend to send that message, but believe me, some will hear that message. So we urge you to delete this provision. What I was going to mention is this actually passed in 2003, a very similar provision, plus a two-year moratorium. Passed in 2003, it did cause no end of confusion. And in fact, you all repealed that in 2005 with support from the Department of Enforcement. It just didn't do anybody any good. That caused a lot of confusion. I know there is the current pay equity coordinator, Facebook. He is here and I could answer any technical questions or any other questions you might have on this, but I'd also be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Watkins. And Representative Nelson, do you have any response to that?
Mr. Chair, and I'll be the first to say that I worked in the public sector when the pay equity laws came on and worked on committees to try and judge the jobs and whatever, and I'm a strong supporter of pay equity. And in the landing bill, as I was pointed out, as I was reminded that we took it out in 1195, but this language is matched up with Senate language at Senator Respieri, and I mean, we were looking at these originally and working with the Senate on this. Senator Rest pointed out that she was one of the chief authors of the time of the pay equity bill originally, and she's the one that left this language in the bill and passed it. It's been passed before and said in this bill.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Question? Okay, Representative Horst.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I guess I would like a little further amplification, because I think a point was made about sending a message about pay equity, and I mean, there's always a conference committee, and that would, you know, the Senate does what they do, and mm-hmm. You know, I think it befuddles us sometimes, I know it does with the labor bill, but if we were to delete the section, would that, what would happen to the bill's prospects? I mean, seems like we could work that out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, personally, if it came out, it wouldn't kill the bill in my mind one way or the other. Like I said, when we put the bill with the delete all amendment, we tried to match up with the provisions that were in the Senate bill as much as possible. There's a few provisions that I did take out of it and that were in the Senate bill. There's, again, the provisions we added back in from House File 1195, because there is not a Senate or a Senate bill that's alive over there, so that we can keep the two bills, keep the stuff that we did earlier on Representative Lanning's bill alive also. So I would not object one way or the other.
Representative Nelson. Mr. Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just respond. ANC obviously strongly supports this provision. They initially came to the committee asking for a full repeal of the reporting requirement. I think what came out of the Senate was a pretty reasonable compromise where we actually give some incentive to folks to comply with the law and make sure that they're good actors. And as far as the concern that there's confusion, I don't know that there's any confusion on the county side of things about the timing. When we speak with our county administrators about this issue in particular, what they've told us is on the county level, they're not seeing enough turnover that there's a huge disparity between a 3-year or a 5-year report. I'm sympathetic to their concerns that they say there's more bad actors. We feel that by giving people the carrot that if you do the right thing, you can do this once every 5 years, and if you don't, you'll be stuck with the old law, is probably a good practice. I can't speak to the, she had a main account about the city, I can't speak to that, but on the county side, I don't think that we had a major issue with this.
Will the testify any other testimonies? Please state your name and organization for the record.
My name is Kate Zemke. I'm the current equity coordinator at the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget. And I just thought I'd offer a couple of clarification points on this. There is a lot of confusion about when to report. We're still kind of recovering from the last time that there was a 5-year gap. I had a call from a county just last week that was supposed to report in 2009, and they phoned and missed it, said we thought it was every 5 years, so now they're out of compliance for failing to report in 2009. The number of jurisdictions that are out of compliance after a 5-year gap, in 2008, we had 182 that were out of compliance initially. That same group of 500 reported last in 2003, and at that time, 102 were out of compliance. So that was a significant increase from the same pool of reporters with that 5-year gap. The other thing is that we do see greater inequities. There was a woman in Elbow Lake who received over a 5-year period a 50 cents per hour wage. The two males in her jurisdiction received each a little over $2 and a little over $4. Her raise amounted to 3% over 5 years, and their raise amounted to 19.5% over 5 years. So at the end of 5 years, there was an equity for her of $2.47 an hour, but she only gets it now. There is no retro provision in the equity bill, so she's just simply out that money for those years and for her retirement and so on. The other thing I would point out is that there already is a waiver provision in the bill that exists, and so any jurisdiction that needs relief in time or whatever budgetary concern can get that now under current legislation, and we work with them all the time. I'm currently working with a school district that was out of compliance a couple of years ago. They're struggling, and so we've got to penalize them. We continue to give them extension and try to figure out how to help them achieve some time. Do you have any questions about that?
Thank you, Ms. Lemke. Any questions? Any other testifiers for or against this bill?
Mr. Chair.
President Kalin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sidebar with Representative Hornstein. I think Ms. Watkins raised some interesting points, but I think hearing from the counties and cities, I think that the message that Ms. Watkins is trying to convey to us and expressing this danger that by changing this that we'd be saying no, that we really don't care about the equity. I think that it's a little bit more ambiguous than that as written. And I think that maybe one of those things that we want to bird dog a little bit and ask Representative Nelson just to speak with Ms. Watkins before the bill makes it to the floor, maybe to its final form, but I don't think it's as clear as was represented to us, and I'd like to know more information. I think there might have been some waiting for a motion to delete that section. I would not support that motion for now, but I would urge Representative Nelson to take her caution seriously and work on it. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to throw caution to the wind and lose this right. Section 21 from the NFL.
Motion on the table. Representative Winkler, it's any discussion to the motion.
Sure. Mr. Chair, like I said earlier, I don't think that the bill hinges on that portion of the bill, and I understand and I fully support pay equity and have worked in that to help that area where I've worked in the past. So, I mean, I would not be against this amendment.
Yeah, can we have a roll call, please? We're going to.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Scully?
Oh, no.
Okay. Hey,
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative
Pittier. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know my staff assistant gets in the way sometimes of our line of sight. The testimony we heard, to me, that was anecdotal and that would seem to speak in support of the amendment. Those of you that serve in committee, or I like to serve in committees where we actually get to probe and pry and ask for the rest of the story. I'd like to see names and dates and what job classifications we talk about, all that stuff. It's a compelling story just off the cuff, but without the ability to actually probe more deeply into what's going on, what did this 152 or 82, whatever it was, over 5 years, how does that break down for years, so on and so forth. There's a whole host of questions we could ask as we kind of flesh this motion out quite a bit further. So while I kind of sympathize with the thrust of the motion, I can't support it, and I would ask that we let the bill stand as the Senate author felt comfortable leaving it stand, and I think we'd be good with that vote. But thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would speak in support of Senator Winkler's motion. This doesn't seem overly onerous to me. I think it's a very important issue. I wouldn't want to send a message that we're somehow compromising this requirement. And we have this pay equity implementation report that was handed out, and it seems pretty straightforward to me about the questions and the information that's being asked of municipalities and counties. So I appreciate your motion, Representative, and I'll be supporting.
Representative Beer?
Nay.
Representative Gibson?
Nay.
Representative Eastman?
No.
Representative Hilty?
Aye.
Representative Hornstein?
Aye.
Representative Kalin?
No.
Representative Lanning?
Yes.
Representative Scalzi?
Yes.
Representative Turner?
No.
Representative Griffith?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Okay, with the motion prevails, it passed. Who's the highest? Okay, proceed. Are any other testimony towards this bill at all? Representative Nelson removes his motion. 1849 as amended. All those in favor? Okay, we're going to pass and have a referred to government operations, technology, and elections. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Commissioner.
House File 424, the next bill on the agenda, Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 424 is a bill relating to the Mississippi River critical area.
Representative Hornsky?
Yeah.
You want to move House File 424?
I would be very happy to move this bill. It's a very good bill.
And I understand there's also an amendment to the bill?
Yes, there is an amendment. I apologize because we have a couple of drafting errors in the amendment.
Okay. Representative Hornstein, would you like to move the DE 6 amendment?
Yes, I'll move the DE 6 amendment.
And Representative Hansen, do you want to explain the technical changes we have to do?
Okay, on the DE 6 amendment, on line 5.2, at the end, in 500, the DE 6 is 2. And then,
repeat that again so I got it here. 5.2.
On line 5.2, the $500 late fee should be $15.
That's why
this is the DE6.
I don't see that on, I don't see on DE 5.2.
5.20.
20, okay. 5.20. Okay. Thank you. That's why I asked twice. I heard 5.2.
5.20.
That should be
the microphone.
That's okay. I just heard the two out this deal. That should be 50, is that?
Correct. And then there was the provision of rules in House File 424 that did not get carried forward. The subdivision 7 that on the bill 5.33 through the 6.2 did not get carried in between 5.27 and 5.28. I again apologize to the committee that I caught this while I was.
So, Representative Hansen, it would be 5.33, subdivision 7, the rules, through 6.2 of the bill.
Correct.
That you want to add in at after 5.27?
Correct.
Discussion, can you clarify that so that we sure we got this in writing?
It's from
Kirsten Grossman.
Kirsten Grossman.
So you
page 5, line 33, subdivision 7 rule.
Correct.
It's to be inserted into the DD 6.5 after line 27.
Correct.
So all of subdivision 7.
Subdivision 7.
All the way through 6.2 where it says register March.
And then you will see on then section 2 the appropriation comes in with the 2.25.
Oh, we have the appropriation.
You have it in 6.2.
Does everybody understand the amendments? And then you got the other 5.20. Station. So we're going to incorporate those changes into the amendment, and then we'll vote on the amendment. Does everybody understand the incorporation? Okay. All those in favor of the amendment with the DE6 amendment as incorporated, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now that the amendment is before us, and that's the bill, would you please explain your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for adopting the amendment with its incorporation. The amendment is the result of continued discussions with a number of the stakeholders who have approached the author, and I believe some of you, about concerns with the bill. In the 2007 legislature, we directed that the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources do a Mississippi River Corridor Critical Area Report, and this is the report that came. And that process involved industry, business, local units of government, and active citizens providing input onto the critical area. Now, what is the critical area? You have in your packet an executive order from 1979. 30 years ago, Governor Twee signed this executive order that relates to the Mississippi River corridor through the Twin Cities. And this executive order has been in effect since 1979. During that time, there have been changes to the executive order. The original responsibility rested with the Environmental Quality Board. Governor Carlson shifted that to the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And the executive order still exists as generally in 30 years ago. My intent with this bill is to try to update the order. I asked in the study process, do we need to continue the PREPA? Is this important? Is this protection important for us to continue? And if so, then we should look at how do we update it, how do we take it into the rulemaking process. And so following the critical area report, I convened an ad hoc study group to look at how we could take the recommendations and prepare those in the statute. That was that process resulted. I just want to say there are disagreements within the study group on where we should go, and I kind of took the process along with Senator Stephen to develop House File 424. In an earlier committee, we adapted the environmental side to with some amendments that matched the Senate, and subsequent to that, the changes that were in the amendment that we just adopted. But I think it would be instructive for the committee to just look at the executive order and look at the statute. We're kind of updating the executive order. The legislature is taking a vote and sending it to the governor. If this moves through the process, I'm giving off the critical area the statute, and we want the Department of Natural Resources to commence with rulemaking. If you think of 30 years ago, the technology that we have, pen and paper, versus today with GIS and LIDAR and the tools that we have for good land use planning, I believe that rulemaking, using the science that we have today, will result in a better outcome for local governments, for business, for industry, and for public participation. The rulemaking process is an open process that involves people. Input could be in there. One of the changes that I made just in the amendment was to make sure that the rulemaking took into account local ordinances. And I know that's been a concern by local municipal governments. We are in a very unique area, the Mississippi River and the confluence of the Mississippi, Carbon, Minnesota, right next to my district, the Mindelocative, called the confluence, the center of the universe, right in the middle. And I'm not sure if it's that, but it is a very important area from our history, from our natural resources, and for commerce. And I believe the critical area recognizes those things. I know there probably are a number of people that would want to provide comments or suggestions. I would open it up if there are people who want to testify on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Are there any questions of the testifier? I know I have one, a couple, and we've talked about this, but I want to get them on the record. This bill in no way, there are a couple of places on the Mississippi, well, by my district, the Coon Rapids Dam, where there used to be electric power generated, and I know there are people looking to be doing that, and I know there are people looking at rebuilding the plant in Minneapolis that fell in the river a few years back. Would this in any way prevent those things from happening? This is renewable energy that I think we all need to be going for.
Mr. Chair, if you look on the DE6 amendment on lines 3.131, 3.32, 3.33, and the final two words on 3.34, it says, the commissioner may provide certain exceptions and criteria for standards, including but not limited to exceptions for river access facilities, water supply facilities, stormwater facilities, wastewater treatment facilities, and hydropower facilities.
Thank you, Representative Hanson. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to speak for or against? I have a note here from Craig Johnson from Alena Cities. Mr. Johnson, please give your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank the author and the supporters of this bill. They've put a tremendous amount of work in as we've struggled trying to figure out how to make this work effectively for cities. This executive order has been in place for a long time, and the decision about whether to make these incorporations in statute or in rule took a long time to figure out what the right route to go was. At the league, so far, we're more comfortable going through the rules process. There's skip to being reasonableness, extensive public hearings, and required findings of fact in response to public comments, a more scientific process. It's great news to you. But there's a lot more expert testimony involved there than a legislative hearing typically. So, to address a couple of local government-specific concerns that we have in the bill, you can go to, in the Delete All Amendment, Subdivision 6. And one of those was substantially addressed in the technical amendment made at the beginning of the hearing, reducing the late fee down to $50. $500 we felt was an extremely punitive amount for a late filing of a public notice to the DNR. The second provision is sub B under subdivision 6. That would be lines 5.25 to 5.27. Specifically, what that allows is DNR, which we local governments under this bill are required to submit any request for a variance, conditional use permit, or a zoning change to DNR 10 days before they take final action on it. This would say that any time DNR spends evaluating that, they just get to bill someone, presumably the local unit of government, and that money is appropriated to them immediately. Not a great disincentive for them to run those costs up as high as they can if it helps them cover staff budgets. So we really don't support that language being in the bill. This bill is designed to take existing requirements of an executive order and put them in rule. There should not be an increase in variances or in work for the DNR. DNR already is looking at these variances when they come before them, and so we don't see a need for added funding for DNR staff if there's no added work. And so that provision we would still like to look at further. I'm sure we will in the Finance Committee if it's not addressed here, Mr. Chair. So with that, I can certainly stand for any questions on city concerns.
Are there any questions for the testifier? Representative Deere.
I don't know if it's much a question as maybe I can make it a question if we're going to play Jeopardy or something. But Mr. Johnson brings up a good point. It's one I've questioned even since my days on city council, and that's on line 5.20. That there's even a fine at all from one unit of government to another one is one that at some point I'd like, perhaps this is a good committee to start that discussion. It annoys me as much as the sales tax that local units of government have to pay. I mean, we raise taxpayer money at the local and county and school district level, and then we take taxpayer money and we pay sales tax to another unit of government. Just that just has never really squared with me. And the ability of one unit of government to fine another unit of government that acquires the money to pay the fine from taxpayers is one that we really need, I think, to have an airing about. Airing as in A-I-R-I-N-G. Because I believe it is actually in error that we do this, Mr. Chairman. And that it was reduced from 500 to 50, I think is a step in the right direction, but I think we're still on the wrong side of the fence. Since I've been viewing the fences, Mr. Hansen, at least on this one, I just, from a policy perspective, I know this is a policy committee, I wanted to get it on the table, that I have a real problem with, and I'd like to have us have a discussion one of these days on why one unit of government can fine another unit of government and what public purpose that possibly serves. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you. I have raised that point in a number of hearings. We actually feel that what DNR's recourse right now is if they feel we have improperly noticed them, they can go to district court and claim that our procedure was not done properly because statute requires 10 days notice and they didn't receive it. They could actually remand the whole decision back, plus run up our legal expenses way beyond $50 for us having made that error in process. So that has been a case I've been discussing with the author, and I'm sure we'll continue to.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hansen, a question with regard to this subdivision 3 on page 3, 10 and following. The commissioners shall establish districts within the Mississippi River corridor, a critical area. Can you explain to me how these districts that are established would relate to existing water management organizations, watershed districts, water management organizations, soil and water conservation, and all the rest of the folks. Is this kind of muddying up our governance here with regard to these issues and getting another player involved?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Van Landing. That's a very good question. I don't know if you have the 79 executive order in front of you.
Should be expected.
I'm just trying to find that. It is not my intent that we're creating another branch that's like a WD or WMO or SWCD. If you look on page 1698 of the state register from March 12th, you will see that there is a, in the executive order, there's used district designations. The corridor has been segmented into four districts: rural open space, urban diversified districts, urban developed districts, and urban open space districts. So those exist right now. The intent of Subdivision 3 is to look at those. Are those, you know, 30-year-old designations, are those the most appropriate? Should there be less? Should there be more? Should they be defined differently? And to take into account the intent, those protection components that were in that original 1979 schedule. So it's kind of a long answer, but I'm not seeing that you create another branch, another set of districts. The districts are the district designations like that was established in executive order on page 1698. And I think with today's technology, you may be able to map these districts better, have better definitions. We hope to have this whole corridor and the rest of the state LIDAR map, so you can use that information and more accurately define the districts. Maybe the name changes, and maybe there's more or less, but that's the intent of some division, not to create another branch of government.
Representative Lamb.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for that explanation. I guess I still wonder about if there might be some confusion about who's responsible for what, and are we creating a situation where people will be wondering, is it the responsibility of these new districts to do it, or what role do other water management organizations need to play in this? And I'm just raising that question. I think we've got so much confusion the way it is right now on who does what and who's responsible for what. That's my concern, Representative Hansen.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Lamb, we've talked about those issues statewide, and I'd be happy to work with you on that. Maybe there's some clarification on what you're putting in here. But it's a very good point, because all along the river there are FWCDs, WMOs, and WDs in addition to all the cities.
I have a John S. Mazzatelli? Mazzatello? Okay, I put an I. Sorry for butchering it. Please give your name for the tape and
good evening. My name is John Mazzatello. I'm the Public Works Director and City Engineer for the City of Mendota Heights. And the City of Mendota Heights would like to thank Representative Hansen for spearheading the efforts behind protection of the Mississippi River Corridor critical area. In 1979, the city of Mendota Heights was one of the first municipalities to pass critical area ordinance in accordance with Executive Order 7919. Ever since, our city has taken great pride in our administration and regulation of that portion of the critical area which falls within our city limits. In fact, we are one of few, if not the only municipality within the critical area to require that all critical area improvements, including all of those that could be approved administratively, receive approval from our city council. We value the critical area that much as a resource for our residents and a resource for the state. When we first saw House File 424 back in February, the city had a number of questions and concerns with the original text of the bill. Through Representative Hansen and through the committee process, we've been able to voice those concerns, and we're pleased that many of these concerns have been addressed in the current text of the bill. This is why the city of Mendota Heights would like to thank Representative Hansen and all the state representatives and senators who are responsible for producing the current version of the bill, for listening to your constituent municipalities and incorporating language in the bill to address our concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Matsugawa.
Any questions for the testifiers? Not? Looking around, Joe. If not, have Whitney Clark. And again, we're trying to get through here tonight, so if you can limit your less than 5 minutes, it'd be great. Mr. Clark, if you would give your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Whitney Clark. I'm the Executive Director of Friends of the Mississippi River. We're a nonprofit citizens organization dedicated to protecting and enhancing the Mississippi River. In the Twin Cities area, we have about 1,600 members, most of them. We've worked very closely with Representative Hansen over the years on critical area issues and worked with him, and want to thank him for his leadership in bringing the bill to this point to your attention today. I think the main thrust of my testimony tonight should be that the purpose of this bill is to try to strike a balance between the importance of continuing to allow and facilitate development within the corridor, and I think that's very clear that the bill is very specific about those uses and the importance of those uses continuing, while at the same time protecting the important natural and scenic values of the river that, after all, make it such an important asset to our community. I think the bill does not remove local authority, and you may hear some testimony tonight to that effect. Local municipalities will continue to regulate the corridor through their critical area plans and ordinances, as they do now, and they will have final say on the granting of variances and other discretionary actions, as they do now under the executive order. Cities will be required to notify the DNR of proposed variances, like they're currently required to do so. In fact, we've reduced the number of days required from 30 to 10 in this legislation in response to concerns from cities. The corridor is already regulated, but with the establishment of the new districts, the revised standards, the idea is that the new districts would be drawn to more carefully follow the geographic features of the river. The river changes more in our 72 miles of the metro area than it does anywhere else along its whole length. If you think of above the falls in Minneapolis, the Prairie River. At St. Anthony Falls, it drops over the only falls on the river and winds its way through a gorge, the only gorge on the river. In downtown St. Paul, opens up into the big floodplain river that most people think of when they think of the Mississippi River. The new districts will allow standards to be written to protect the features and the resources in those areas. And they'll focus on protecting resources as opposed to protecting land use patterns, which the current executive order does. So, in the current executive order, two out of the four districts discourage or prohibit industrial and commercial land uses. That is very likely to change under the new rules. So in closing, I guess I would say the river is one of our claims to fame here in Minnesota, a headwater state. We're blessed to have it flow through our metro area. And I think we've got a responsibility to try to update this law, bring it into the 21st century, and do a better job of balancing the ecological and scenic and public values with the private and business. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Is there any questions for the testifier? Representative Disney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the testifier could share some instances where the private and business sector is not being respectful of the river, I'd appreciate that.
Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the process of preparing the study that the DNR did fall 2007, we led the stakeholder outreach for that. We had a meeting where we just specifically brought together river businesses and developers to ask them how critical areas were. We had a separate meeting for city where we just asked city staff mostly to come and talk to us about critical area. We had a meeting where we brought citizens, neighborhood groups, environmental groups together, asking the same questions. Pretty striking. One of the results was, and it's, you know, it's laid out pretty well in the report, which I urge you to take a look at, but everybody agreed that the existing executive order was clunky, it was hard to understand, it was difficult to enforce. Developers were concerned that there was not a level playing field within communities, between communities. Cities had a hard time understanding the standards, and so standards vary from community to community. And because of that variation, because of the distinct differences, the situation is ripe for conflict, and we've seen that in many cities. So this is, the law is an attempt to, this bill is an attempt to address that by walking through, as Craig Johnson said in his testimony, a very deliberative process, a rulemaking process to establish new standards that are clear and new districts that are clear and better followed.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Business.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this bill has a ways to go, but the testimony was pretty straightforward. Your words were pretty straightforward, that we have to strike a better balance between the public and the scenic nature of the river and the private and commercial nature. If we need to strike a better balance, then there has to be some examples of the imbalance that you're talking about. And if you can provide some specific examples for us as legislators so that it's not just anecdotal and maybe in somewhere, otherwise it looks like a solution looking for a problem. If there's a problem out there, I'd like to know what it is.
Mr. Clark.
Mr. Chair, I think what I said was that this bill was an intent to balance the interest of development and commerce with the interest of protecting the river. And so I'm trying to say that we're trying to do this balancing act with this piece of legislation. It's got to do both. And updating it is a way to make it clear and make it easier for the people who have to use it on both on all sides of the issue to be able to do that. That would be a
chat
of my testimony.
Representative Distance.
Thank you. I guess I just have once new rules are developed and there's kind of a new standard that we're using, what then is going to be the method of dealing with development or things that currently exist along the river that maybe aren't in compliance with what kind of the new rules would suggest should be the standard?
Mr. Clark. Well, Mr. We're Representative Hanson, you do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I think we don't know what the new districts will be. We don't know what the new standards will be. So, there's nowhere where we can say, in this location, there will be rules that are more restrictive or less restrictive, but it could obviously happen. And in that case, we'll have cities will continue to have the authority as they do now to approve new land uses and rate variances for uses that for requests where there are non-conforming uses.
Representative Hanson.
Mr. Chairman, I do not see any additional authority to this department than currently existing executive order that they can provide that review to the local union government, and the local government has that say. So I'm not, and I know that's a concern, and you'll probably hear that concern from folks, but I'm not looking at additional authority beyond what we already have in the executive order.
Mr.
Chair.
I would say, is there anything specifically in the bill that kind of would give a little comfort language about that? I mean, if there is a certain amount of of investment, commerce, development that, that's already been made, and all of a sudden it's going to be targeted as something that really doesn't fit the new model that we're looking for here. Is there going to be lots of economic pressure on someone that's already invested a lot of economic capital into a location there? Are all of a sudden they going to be penalized because of this, or is this going to be for development going forward?
Representative Hansen.
Sure, if you look at the permitting, if you look at lines 3.30 and 3.31, the fisherman must take into account the ordinances when developing the guidelines and standards. I think that's one protection that's there. And then to go above that, when you look at the definitional, just the ensure the corridor is managed in a way that conserves the scenic and environmental recreational mineral economic control. Maintains the river channel for transportation by providing and maintaining barging and feeding areas in appropriate locations. Consistent with, just through 3, 4, 5, and then again in subdivision 3, you get into existing ordinances. And it also references that at 116G.13, protection of landowners' rights, which is in the critical areas.
And that's referenced in the bill?
Was that an answer? And Mr. Clark?
And Mr. Chair, elsewhere in 116G is 0.13 is a subdivision title protection of landowner rights that addresses nothing in section 116G01 or 116G14 authorizes any governmental agency to adopt a rule or issue any order that's unduly restrictive or constitutes a taking of real or personal property in violation of the Constitution of the U.S. It goes on to, because it has additional language about the invasion of the U.S. Mr. Chair, if you look on lines 1.7, if this on the disease, it does say that this is an area of critical concern in accordance with this chapter, which ties back in the 116. That's your loop back over that.
Representative Eastman.
Mr. Chair, and I guess, not having a brilliant opportunity to look through that and see how all that connects. I guess, the concern I have is that I think that, the intention here is what we're all supportive of, but I guess I also know that there's lots of investment that has already taken place in the corridor, that could all of a sudden be subject to a new set of standards that's going to require significant changes, significant other financial investments just to stay there. And I guess I would just want to know that that's going to be minimized, that there would be some kind of a grandfathering kind of a concept here that we're not going to apply all of these new rules to somebody that was complying prior to the institution of these. And I think that's just an important concept that I'd like to see clarified and make sure that it's at least emphasized going forward from here.
Senator Hanson, Mr. Clark. Okay. Well, Representative Beard, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I'm looking through this, I've got this definition sheet that says that there's going to be 4 land use districts. Maybe this is for either the testifier or Representative Hansen. And, of course, I'm concerned that as I look in here, I don't see anything about the St. Paul Downtown Airport, for one thing. And I know there's been some movement about undoing the airport, moving it out of there, returning that land to its marshland quality or whatever it was several decades ago. But, Mr. Representative Hansen, can you assure me that this is not a back door to undo the airport?
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I have no intent of undoing the airport. Actually, I think that the point you raise shows why these old district definitions, that we could have a new district definition of the airport and a better defined than what we have here. So I think you raise a good example. I am not trying to.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I trust you. It's the other people who are going to be making the rules and entering the rulemaking process. Those are the ones that I'm concerned about. And as long as we're talking about it, I want to be sure that these 4 districts and standards for each district makes lots of room for two oil refineries, one on each bank of the river, some sand and gravel mining and things like that that certain folks may look askance at, and if they don't use the rulemaking process to write them out of the standards and the districts that are going to be made, and now we've got a huge economic impact we weren't counting on.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, I apologize, we don't have a map so you can see where those are.
Yeah.
Get that for the committee so you can see where those existing four districts are.
Okay. Representative Beard, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted that on the tape, and I want everybody to hear my concerns about this going forward, but this is not my area of expertise. I appreciate what you're trying to do, Representative Hanson, but just, you know, I think about others that may not see the world quite the same way we do, so thank you.
I have a seal from Bedore. Bedore, okay, from the city temple. And if you could make limited to new testimony and not repeat what other people have said, please, I'm going to get a vote on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I'm here on behalf of Councilmember Harris, who couldn't be here today, but asked me to read a short statement to you. Protection and enhancement of the river corridor is the centerpiece of St. Paul's plans and policies and has been for many, many years. The City Council adopted a River Corridor Plan in 1981, River Corridor Overlay Zoning District in 1982, and updated the River Corridor Plan in 2002. These actions ensured St. Paul's compliance with Executive Order 7919 to manage the Mississippi River Corridor as, quote, multiple purpose resource consistent with its natural characteristics and its existing development, and, quote, conserve the scenic, environmental, recreational, mineral, economic, cultural, and historic resource functions of the River Corridor. Obviously, the Mississippi River Corridor is a critical resource to the city of St. Paul. In fact, the critical area encompasses 27% of the city of St. Paul's land. As an elected official, I'm sure all my elected colleagues on the city council would agree, I take our stewardship of this important asset very seriously. As you'll hear from my colleagues that are here today, we've also worked tirelessly over the years to ensure a balanced approach to protecting this area. I am quite concerned with the fact that this bill takes away local authority for establishment of land use and zoning regulations and gives this authority to the DNR. Local units of government are uniquely suited to prepare and adopt zoning regulations that fit local conditions and balance a broad range of policies and plans using an open, inclusive public process. The Foresight Task Force is a very good example of St. Paul's consistent, open, and inclusive process. Our 25-member task force worked for over 1.5 years to develop scenarios suitable for this site, paying close attention to the river and the site's connectivity to it. In addition to the task force, we developed an interagency technical advisory group, which includes the DNR and the National Park Service, to advise on planning issues related to the river. I can assure you that our St. Paul citizens, my colleagues on the council, and I will not move forward development that will compromise the river and its qualities as a natural and scenic resource of the city. Removing the City of St. Paul's authority to regulate 27% of its land compromises efforts of our planning staff, planning commission, and our neighborhood representatives. I cannot support giving the DNR this authority, as this bill does, to establish regulations and use district designations that may be inconsistent with the character of existing development. Use district designations, definitions, and restrictions supported by the DNR in the past, had they passed, would have increased requests for non-conforming uses and variances that ultimately are the responsibility of local units of government to resolve. In addition to being a hardship to property owners with detrimental economic impact, this would be a mandate that would be a significant cost to local governance. Finally, cities are in a difficult position with respect to paying the DNR to review local review and action on development permits. Adding this additional review is costly, and I know our inclusive, thoughtful process, which often includes the DNR, provides for the necessary and critical review our citizens expect. I apologize for not being present at the hearing today. Please feel free to contact me at your convenience with any questions. Mr. Harris appreciates the opportunity to present this. And if I may, Mr. Chair, very briefly, as a chair or as the director of planning and economic development for the City of St. Paul, under the current law, as you know, cities draft regulations that are consistent with critical area criteria that fit our city. These regulations do not go into effect until the DNR approves those. So they have that authority now, and the system works well the way it is now. Having said that, we are very, very grateful for the open door and thoughtful settlement that you've shown, Representative Hanson, in trying to make this bill work. I'm respectfully requesting that you consider giving local governments more time to work with Representative Hanson on this bill to ensure that our mutual interests of respecting this really critical natural resource is met while also respecting the role of local elected officials to balance multiple needs and interests. And I should add, they also have other colleagues here today, Mr. Brian Alton, who's the chair of our Planning Commission, and Gregory Page, who's the chair of our Critical Area Task Force, who can really provide more detail in terms of the work that the city of St. Paul does to protect this. I also just want to note that building trades, the Chamber of Commerce, the St. Paul Port Authority, the St. Paul Board of Realtors, our Building and Owners Management Managers Association, landowners, and other citizens are here as well and share these concerns.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you,
Mr. Dorn. That was quickly. I hate to see you go long. Representative Eastland, you had a question.
Yeah, just one question. Just when you first started to speak and you kind of described the uses of the river that seemed appropriate in the way you were describing St. Paul's policy and connecting that with what Representative Beard had talked about earlier, could we get a copy of those printed comments that you read?
I'll have to email them to you around because they're all scratched over, but I guess I'll get
them. I appreciate it if we get a copy of that. Thank you.
If you could send it to the whole committee, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
Any other questions for the testifier? Is there anybody else who would like to speak for or against the bill? If you could make it quick, just keep it to 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief on that. My name is Gregory Page, and I am the citizen chair of the Critical Area Task Force in St. Paul. I also serve as the Special Projects Director for the St. Paul Riverfront Corporation. This bill may very well have been encouraged by the hard work of St. Paul, as they are finishing the critical area zoning update, which is required. Although it is not through City Council, I want to very briefly share with you the process that St. Paul has gone through. The task force was made up of an extremely diverse group representing all sectors of the community, the DNR and the Chamber of Commerce, the National Park Service, and the Port Authority, Friends of Parks and Trails, river industry representatives, and neighborhood ecological advocates. We worked very hard to balance the executive order's call for managing the critical area corridor, and I reiterate what Cecile Bedore said, to conserve the scenic, environmental, recreational, mineral, economic, cultural, and historic resources and functions of the river. Resources is more than simply the scenic. All of these are important. And these things are unique to each community. The task force, I believe, did an exemplary job of developing specific and enforceable language to these stated purposes within St. Paul's unique conditions. We wrestled with strategic and contentious issues for 2 years, meeting monthly, then biweekly, and finally weekly to accomplish our task to present to the City Council via the Planning Commission our recommendations for updating St. Paul's critical area ordinance. A portion of each meeting was made available to members of the general public as well as other stakeholders or special interest groups to address the task force on both broad and specific issues. City staff could go into all our recommendations and are continuing to work with Representative Hansen on potential input to this bill. My point, quite simply, is that St. Paul is unique for its size, staff, and community capacity and its commitment to the river to execute its own ordinances and exercise its own authority in this area. Please consider recognizing St. Paul's unique position and its critical area work in your bill.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? If not, see if there's somebody else.
Thank you.
Anybody else would like to testify for or against?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Very briefly, my name is Brian Alton. I'm the chair of the St. Paul Planning Commission, and I just wanted to give you a couple of brief comments. The Mississippi River is a very important resource for the city of St. Paul, but these proposed critical area amendments would be detrimental to St. Paul and would not necessarily achieve the goals of the bill. The state requires municipalities to engage in planning, and we do that very seriously in the city of St. Paul. We are equipped to deal with issues of zoning, rezoning, land use, variances, and so forth. And we measure and consider competing interests, policies, and interests involving statutory requirements and issues that are unique to our community. The state requires us, mandates us to engage in this planning process. And House File 424 would take away the local authority over zoning and land use regulations in this critical area. It would give unprecedented authority to a state agency without local input. It would affect large areas of the city where we have had citizen committees, city staff, and other experts work thousands of hours in a good planning process. we wish to be able to continue to do our planning work to preserve the river corridor and enhance the livability of our city. There will be no threat to future protection of the river within the borders of the city of St. Paul that will be stopped by this legislation. Thank you for your consideration. I did want to make one further comment with respect to the comment for Representative Eastland. In House, in the Executive Order 79.19, there was specific language that could be carried forward into this law that addresses the manner in which the river is managed. And that language in 79.17 says that rivers be managed as a multi-purpose resource consistent with its natural characteristics and its existing development, the purpose of the critical area designation, and the general guidelines for preparing plans and regulations. So I just want to make that. Thank you very much for your opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Dalton. Dalton?
Dalton.
Dalton. Next testifier. And if you can, please not repeat what somebody else has said. We don't need to keep hearing the same thing over and over.
I would like to address first Richard Townsend Anderson, the resident of Brooklyn Park and vice chair of the River Community Coalition, which is a group that arose out of opposition to the DNR's proposed zoning that occurred 10 years ago. And we heard that the DNR is losing authority, substantial authority, as regards zoning. The testimony was given that they would not settle. That resides in the communities, but I would like to. The Metropolitan Council shall incorporate the standards developed under this section in its planning and shall work with local units of government and the commissioner to ensure the standards are being adopted and implemented. That is enforcement language. And as such, it makes me very nervous because the zoning, as was promulgated 10 years ago, made my house and all of the other houses in Brooklyn Park, Fountain River, non-conforming. And it wasn't until we finished about a year and a half of ardent struggle with the city council that we were grandfathered in our present footprint, assuring us that we would be able to continue to repair, replace, and do the normal things that a property owner could do. Given the DNR unquestioned and unappealable authority in this area, scares us to death because of our history with the DNR. Now, it was a different commissioner, it was a different outfit, but nonetheless, its history is there. One other thing, the scenic river on north of the Coon Rapids Dam is a human creation. It is an urban forest, it is not a natural forest. The natural complement of that river at that time was the shortgrass prairie, farmland, potato ground, hence Brooklyn Park's potato base. It comes from a historic use of that material. As such, if we were to restore to natural use, you'd have to rip out all the trees, all the brush, restore it to shortgrass prairie. That's not necessary because of the economic impact of owning property along the river. People have poured literally tens of millions of dollars per year, not over the history, but each year. And our own short street, I've seen over $2 million put in last year for beautification, shoreline protection, halting erosion, etc. What erosion there is north of the dam is caused largely by public land. The Coon Rapids Dam State Park is there. That is the eroded acreage. The personal owned property is very protected. No one wants to lose their property. The trees, we planted them. The plantings, the gardens, the beautiful flowers, we planted them. All of that was done voluntarily. If instead we substitute the authority of the DNR with some scenic natural provision, we lose what we put in and lose as well its economic value that caused us to invest so heavily in a property. The average home price up there is over $500,000. And we protect it and we encourage it and we do the best we can to increase its beauty and its value. I'm afraid that this bill as given will have a serious impact on the value of the beautification and the scenic viability of those residential areas. And there's no appeal. Once the rules are in place, I think we have to go back to the legislature to change the rules. And there is no real appeal to these things. And so, like I said, the residents that I speak to and who are part of the organization go from being mildly afraid to being rapidly furious, you know, and defining take as you know, liberty is keeping your pants off. We're doing the job, and we're doing a good job, a better job than the public use is doing. Shingle Creek, salt pouring into the river.
If you could wrap up.
Yes, anyway, the kinds of pollutants that go into the river don't come from us. They come from further inland via sewers, stone sewers, etc. What we do is protect the river. What others do is abuse the river. But we're getting the onus of regulation. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your testimony. Next. Please identify. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the tape. And
City of Mendota, City Administrator. And actually, I just would like a little clarification more than anything else. Under the definition, there's talk about development. What defines a development? One house, five houses, a PUD. I guess we would like that clarification.
Representative Hanson, would you be able to answer that? Or?
I think on this and several of the previous testimonies, if you look at starting with the commissioner show on lines 2.27 and the management of the corridor, conserves scenic, environmental, recreation, mineral, economic, cultural, and historic resources, and goes to number 2, maintains the river channel. And then item number 3 provides for the continuation and development of a variety of urban uses, including industrial and commercial uses and residential uses where appropriate. Commercial and industrial uses and residential uses where appropriate.
I guess there was a
difference
in the commission looking at the resources of all developments in the quarter entire. So one house being developed. One house being developed.
Okay. This is not testimony, is it? But the representatives can answer, ask questions. You can give testimony.
Okay. Currently, there is four districts under the executive order 7919.
Mm-hmm. I believe that question was answered earlier by a question from the committee by Representative Hanson that they may be changed, they may be more, they may be less, but that's something that that's something you'll have to deal with. You're here, you've got testimony to give. We're here to hear your testimony.
I guess my testimony is just taking the price of
the
questions that we try to help cities, at least by Minnesota, that if this goes forward, I don't think those questions are being answered.
But
well,
I was.
Yeah. Okay.
Then I would suggest that you continue working with Representative Hanson and talk to him. I'm sure he'd answer your questions and work with you. This is going to other committees before it gets to the floor, so I would suggest that you work with Representative Hanson. Sorry about that. Any further testimony?
The Friends support this legislation and the passage of this bill. We're a 24-year nonprofit membership organization and our hope is to preserve parks, trails, and open space in St. Paul and Ramsey County. The Friends have a special interest in the Mississippi River Corridor, and I just wanted to state that I was on the Citizens League in the 70s and used the organization to go to Wendell Anderson to declare the Mississippi River a critical area. I served on the first planning for the first river corridor planning in the city of St. Paul. And when Gregory Page was speaking, I served on that committee for the new zoning ordinance. All I want to say then is that we support this bill as it is, and believe that we need to. Local governments sometimes have a hard time looking at a state or international resource, and we support this legislation today.
Any questions for the testifier? I'm going to take about 2 more testifiers, and then I'm going to call a question on the bill because we have plenty for both sides, and otherwise we'll be here all night.
Identify yourself on the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Lori Lauder. I am the Director of Business and Governmental Affairs at the St. Paul Port Authority. I'll be very brief. You have a letter from us signed by Louis Jamboy, our CEO, so I won't go through those details. Just a few things. The Building Owners Association and the Chamber and the Port Authority find themselves on the same side of the argument as far as being very concerned about this legislation. I want to thank Representative Hansen for all of his patience in meeting with us and hearing from us. We really appreciate it. The Port Authority's mission is business and jobs growth and tax-based growth, and also it is to be a good environmental steward. We clean up brownfields. We are the steward of the Mississippi River. Specifically, Mr. Chair, in the critical areas over the past 25 years, the Port Authority has donated over 1,800 acres to serve as open space in perpetuity. This is Lilidale, Pig's Eye, across the farm areas and such. Wanted to mention a specific concern, Mr. Chair, if I might, on page 2, lines 2.33 through 2.35. It references maintaining the river channel for transportation, and specifically references barging and fleeting areas. We appreciate that. However, what is missing there is any reference to the river shipping terminal areas. These are the land areas that are so very critical to our shipping operations in the St. Paul Harbor. As many or most of you may know, one of the key functions of the St. Paul Harbor is to bring farmers' products to the worldwide market at reasonable rates. So, bottom line, Mr. Chair and members, we still have some concern. We'd like some more time to work on it with Representative Hansen. We appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
One more testifier, and thank you, Mr. Slaughter. Thank you, sir.
Chairman?
Robert, could you please give your name? And,
my name is David Griggs, and I'm a builder, and I had the pleasure of working with Senator Hansen in the last stakeholders meetings in preparing this. And where I see it is that there was this is being driven by a handful of people. And I think what's best said over here is a solution looking for a problem. I think all the cities have their building ordinances in place, and they adhere to them. And I believe some of the things that here are being put in the law, like an 18% slope. If any of you live in a walkout ramp, that's an 18% slope. I think it's quite prohibitive. That's my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Greaves. Is there any questions for the testifier? Mr. Hope, Representative Hornstein.
Hi, Mr. Chair. Thank you. In the sense where you had mentioned that you were participating in the stakeholder meetings, did some of these issues come up that you... sometimes, you know, these things happen and we hear about it, but you don't make the appearance. What?
It was a handful that controlled this legislation.
Representative Hornstein.
Okay, but did you specifically raise this in the committee?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Grace.
The only other observation is I don't believe a lot of cities were kept up to date and abreast of how this is progressing.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Hansen, if you want to wrap up. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. And just that this bill was introduced, I think, probably 6 weeks ago. It has moved through one committee in the House, and it's moved through two committees in the Senate. There have been public hearings on the bill. I do want to just correct something for Representative Eastland. I referenced 116G13, and staff has notified me there is an error in terms of what I said in terms of wrapping in. But that piece doesn't appear to be moved with the other 14 subdivisions. So I would like to work with staff on that to find out. I don't have the whole red book in front of me here, but I told you something that I think informed there's a change to that, so I'm going to look at that with council, maybe with you, if this passes out of the committee. Members, I appreciate the time spent. I know this is a very difficult and complex area. We have continued to try to make changes to address some of the concerns. There's concerns I'll continue to work on if this passes. I would ask for your support for this bill to move on to the next committee to be able to do that.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein then renews his motion that House File 424, as amended, be recommended, passed, and be referred to state local government operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill's passed. The next bill on the agenda is House File 986, Representative Tiefner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Winkler moves House File 986. We recommend it to pass and referred to state local government. And Representative Tiefner, if you proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer. And I wasn't sure, Mr. Chair, if you wanted to talk about the first article, which is about human services maintenance of effort, which we did deal with in my committee. If people want to talk about that, we can. My understanding is it's more about Article 2 that we're interested in this committee.
That is correct. But okay. If you have questions, we can make any questions on that.
Yeah, so that's fine. I'll focus on Article 2 then, which is a piece of legislation that actually Representative Solberg is carrying separately, but we wanted to get in front of your committee to take... to make sure that we got a full airing of it, and the legislation relates to how counties can better and more efficiently work together. And there's been a lot of discussion about integrating or consolidating counties, especially human services, work in counties. And this proposal is coming forward as an attempt to move in that direction. Really, the pain point I'd like to make is the basic philosophy of this piece of legislation is we can move in the direction of consolidating and having counties work together in kind of a form before function methodology, which would say we're going to just consolidate you in a certain geographic information and then you figure out how to work together, or we can work, start with the function, which is how we actually deliver services to people, and let the form follow that. This proposal adopts that latter perspective, which is basically to say there's a lot of county cooperation going on today. And what we want to do is try to accelerate that, but we don't want to get in the way of it with some false formalities and false structures being put in place. So what this would allow it to do is to create, basically, the counties would have to come together and form what are called, and now I'm losing the word, exact words, service delivery authorities. Thank you. And they would do that by contract, but it wouldn't just be among the counties. It would also include the state as well as part of that discussion. And so what they would set in place are performance expectations. They would set in place expectations about what the state participation and what the local participation is going to be. And they would just set in place understanding about how the different roles and responsibilities of the different entities going forward to deliver particular kinds of services or all kinds of services, depending on the choice of the county and the state. And so what we're doing is it's something different than we've done before, which is to get the state and the counties actually working together to figure out how can we best deliver these services in a way that makes the most sense in those areas. Counties that are greater than 55,000 could be their own service delivery authority. Counties under 55,000 would have to combine in geographic groups in close proximity, or if they feel like they can make the case that they can meet the performance standards but not have to get all the way to 55,000, they could get a waiver for that as well. And then it's also creating to try to build the state-county partnership and trust, which is really what's been lacking in our system, I think, an oversight council that would include the Department of Human Services, county representatives, some legislators, to actually go through and make recommendations about which of these agreements make sense, what kind of waivers from some state statutes we may need in order to let the counties fulfill their work more efficiently and effectively and allow for more local control, all in the end, which would have to come back to us, of course. But I think what this sets up is a much more cooperative situation going forward with regard to the counties and states, and particularly the human services area, working together. And I do have a testifier who may want to give just a little brief background, if that's okay.
That'd be great. Please welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Kelly Harder. I'm the Human Services Director in Steele County, also co-chair of the NACSA Legislative Committee, but I'm here on behalf of counties. Representative Thiessen did a very comprehensive job outlining, I think, the framework. The only piece that I would add is to say on behalf of counties, I don't know how often we sit in front of all of you and say, hold us more accountable. that's, and we believe that working with the state with a higher level of oversight, that by bringing the systems together from the department and the counties, we can bring a greater return on the tax dollar to the desired outcome we want. And we want to be more, and that transparency comes with it as well. And we come with you with this proposal, and that with true authentic engagement by the department with the oversight of that committee. And the service delivery authority does not preclude the public health, the veteran services, and corrections in us working to coordinate beyond just the human services as well. So we appreciate that. We'd entertain any questions as well. Thank you.
Are there any questions from the committee? Representative here.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I became aware about 6 months ago of, is it Mr. Harder, that Scott County was involved behind the scenes in some quiet discussions with 10 or 11 other counties. Is this part of that collaboration that had already been working on before the governor announced it in the State of the State? In fact, I think he maybe even snuck the idea from you guys. But,
Representative Harder?
It sounded like a marvelous project, and Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Harder?
Form over process, process over form. I like the way you're heading with this to allow these counties to take their own initiative and actually move ahead with this before we get bogged down and us telling them how to do it. Mr. Harder.
Mr. Chair, in fact, we've been working on this for years, and it is based on research. It's based on other states' best practices out of Iowa that won a national award. The counties ourselves in MAXA, we're writing it called Explore Voluntary Human Service Multi-Collaboration. And if you look at the title, I think most importantly, this legislation was titled very purposefully, State, County, not one, not the other. Together we bring results, accountability, and it is service delivery redesign. We're ready to do this, we're wanting to do it, and we're willing to authentically engage the department in this.
Representative Beard?
I would just give them a chance to brag a little bit, because okay. I was pretty proud of these guys thinking this up all on their own and bringing it to us.
Any more questions of the committee? Representative Eastland.
What can you tell us a little bit about how counties in general across the state are looking at this kind of a proposal?
Mr. Chairman, this is coming from both MACSA, which are the County Social Services Workers, and the Minnesota Counties Association. Both have worked on and support this approach to the thing. And again, it's voluntary in the sense, it's voluntary, so they don't have to do it. We think a lot of counties. Well, first of all, I think are doing it, but more will, and we can accelerate that kind of cooperation.
Upset Eastland.
Yeah, I mean, my county is doing some of this now, and they were offended when the governor's proposal came out. I don't know if they were going to. So I mean, I think this is a much softer view, and if we can move down this road and kind of accomplish the same end, I think it helps everybody to get there and do a little more civilly. So,
Mr. Sterner. Harder.
Mr. Chair.
Looking at you.
You know, I want to also say that not every county lined up to say me first on this. There's some real challenges in reality. We've walked those theoretical white elephants in the room. We've had hard conversations. We all realize we're at different times economically. The other thing is just as an example, in counties that are already partnering, Steele County alone has 47 partnerships we're engaged with. We believe in building on those from that service level.
Chair, I renew my motion.
Representative Sterner. Oh. I believe this is a testifier.
Oh. I can try.
I just had a question with the actual system. And most times, what my experience is, the system doesn't matter where they get the service from as long as it's good quality service. But this proposal would give our citizens equal access to service regardless of whether they are using some of the counties. With this, because I don't like some of the chemical dependency on dollars right now aren't people spread upon the state intent, which I don't inform them on.
But Mr. Chair, the Senator, I think this is more about the delivery. I think there's other questions, and it's good, aiming particularly the chemical dependency, that's about maintenance of effort and how we spread those dollars along. I think this can go a ways towards figuring out how we can cooperate and better use those dollars and provide the services more effectively.
But this is making delivery more efficient, so then we can take this.
Thank you. Get it up the test of fire here. Please identify yourself on the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Tim Wilkin, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Human Services. I just want to give you some feedback on the legislation that's in front of you. This was in response, actually, to the governor's introduction of a bill to do something similar, a county redesign, if you will. In the last committee, this legislation got tacked on to our bill, and then it's carried parallel on Representative Teaser's bill. We want to thank the counties for the feedback they've given us on that bill. We actually proposed some fairly significant changes to the governor's proposal in the last committee before this language got attached. I just want to go through a few concerns we have on this. This is actually an issue that DHS has been working with the counties for many years on how to deliver services differently. Just for some background, the legislature in 1973 actually adopted some legislation to encourage counties to collaborate and on human services specifically and form some multi-county delivery units. And since that time in 1973, there has been two established, Lincoln Lyon Murray, and the other one is Faribault Martin. So it's the pilot projects are out there. They've been successful, but that's as far as it went. We don't think this particular proposal will actually add any incentives to get more participation in it. The legislative auditor in 2007 reviewed human services delivery, and what they said was, from the counties, they said they haven't done more because there's no financial incentives, there's no requirement to do it, and it's politically difficult. Well, we're trying to provide financial incentives in the governor's proposal. I know that's not in front of you now, Mr. Chairman, but I do want to give a little feedback on the bill that's in front of you. If you look at line 7.28, it has a provision for an annual opt-out. And it makes it, when we're trying to form this proposal, we're trying to do it in a way where you get it done once. You can't come back every year and change the delivery system. Who's participating with whom? It's not like you want to do this even every 10 years, like redistricting. You want to redo it and form Human Services 2.0 and take it to the next level because we need to do something different from the system that was developed in 1923 to a system where we've got multiple human service programs, we've got more complex human service programs, we've got much bigger human service programs. So we're trying to find something where you put the puzzle together once and not have an opt-in and opt-out every year. On the next page is the Oversight Council. We're concerned that this changes the nature of the current system, which for human services is a county-administered, state-supervised program. This redefines those roles, and it basically takes, if the legislature is in this part, is delegating authority for oversight to this council. And the council is made up of a majority of county people. It's not a majority legislature, it's not even a balance between state and county. It's a clear majority for county representation. It also puts, at 8.24, puts the legislative research at the disposal of this oversight council. Going to the next page. It actually, on 9.1 and 9.3, it adds steps to the current legislation that's out there where counties can come together and collaborate. Now they have to go to the oversight board and get kind of the blessing of the oversight board. On 9.7, it establishes a due process. The oversight board will establish a due process system over the commissioner's decisions. That's legislative and executive authority that oversees that. And so it would be delegating considerable authority to this oversight board. I can tell you often that the decisions by the commissioner need to be fairly timely because we're dealing with human services issues, and there's a very broad range of those. I'll try to be quick because I know everybody wants to go to the Ranger party. I'm sure nobody's eating everything. If you go to 11.13 on the duties, the legislation that's in front of you is really patterned after the governor's proposal with the timelines here. The timelines were in place because there was a financial incentive that needed to be done, put in place, and those parallel the budgeting process and the timelines for the budget. This doesn't really work because it really creates an annual three-step process for the counties to go through to participate in this. Lines 11.32 create a governance agreement. This is, again, stepping into a legislative prerogative. What happens, I think you got to ask yourself, what happens when there's a governance agreement that contradicts legislation? And then there's kind of an ill-defined waiver that would be give the commissioner waivers. We're happy to take waiver authority, but the legislature would have to define authority what programs you can give waivers on. And 12.11, there is a service level agreement. And again, this kind of conflicts with legislative prerogative and the executive prerogative because we don't know what our appropriation is going to be for it, for whatever is supporting this service level agreement. And that outlines the basics. I can tell you we're working with the counties. We actually have a meeting scheduled with Mr. Harder and Mr. Moeller from AMC tomorrow to try to work out some of the differences, and we'll work with the authors also on trying to bring something together here. But it's important when we're thinking of this, how to redesign the human services system. It can't be piecemeal. It can't be a few collaborations here, a few collaborations there, or a group of counties here and a group of counties there. You got to look at it. If you had the map and you were drawing it yourself, would you stick with a grid of 87 counties delivering services, recognizing that it's about 84 now with the current two collaborations that are going on? Or would you try to do it in a wholesale manner that takes all the counties into consideration and tries to do it in a thoughtful way rather than more an ad hoc approach over the years? I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you. Representative Diskin, do you have a question? Was it either for this one or the previous testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually did the author of the bill.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr.
Mr. Chair, I'm representing the piece, and it is section 4 on page 8 that does get me concerned. Representative Peason, what can this oversight council do that the largest department in state government can't already do?
Mr. Chair, if the question is the power that this Oversight Council is really just making recommendations to the department. But what it does, and what the fundamental problem, one of the fundamental problems I see with the relationship between the state and the local county government, especially human services, which is where I see most of this stuff, is that there's a huge lack of trust and a huge lack of cooperation between the two. And I think what this advisory council does is it actually can bring that process into much closer cooperation and understanding. As to the makeup of the council, I'm happy to work on that. If there's a need to provide more balance as we move forward here, that I'm happy to do. But what we don't have, I think what the problem we have in Minnesota state government is we have a state that has a one-size-fits-all attitude towards human services, and in fact often gets in the way of county collaboration because they want to impose their ideas on the county. That's what the effort part of that issue comes down to, and that's what is going on here. I think one of the things in response to Mr. Commissioner Wilkins' comment is the governor, and first of all, I'll give the governor all the credit he needs for moving forward on county consolidation and improving things. If he wants to take credit, he's welcome to do it. But what the thing I think has in where the governor's coming from and what I hear Commissioner Wilkins comes from is he has a map in his head. And he's saying, if it's not on the map, we're not doing anything. And in fact, counties are doing all kinds of collaboration right now. And so the story about going from 87 to 84 since 1967 or whenever the date came, you know, that's kind of irrelevant because counties are collaborating today. They just don't show up on the map. And so I hope that we don't stick ourselves into the thinking it's got to show up on a map somewhere on somebody's wall. but that we recognize that there's all kinds of collaboration actually going forward, and we can accelerate that if we actually have the counties and the departments working together to make sure that happens. And that's what really the Oversight Council is all about. And I just do also want to say, this doesn't impose additional steps on cooperation, because they still can go through the traditional joint powers agreement where they actually just enter contracts with each other. But if they want to create this kind of more efficient, effective authority, then they would go through this process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Thiessen, I think the biggest concern of this council in my mind is on page 9, line 7. And that gives me a little heartburn there.
And Mr. Chair, I don't think the intent is that this advisory council would be the due process overseer of the Department of Human Services. I think I'm happy to work with anybody on how we develop them. I mean, I think it's more just to create some kind of due process arrangement I will agree, as we move this forward, need to be more clear, I think, in the legislation about what the legislature's role in this. And it's not, I will admit that it's not as clear as it should be in the legislation. But at the end of the day, this stuff should be coming back. If we make fundamental changes in our waiving state laws and that are very broad, we need to make sure we have a role in that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that,
why don't you wrap up and then
I'll wrap up.
Okay. Representative Winkler renews his motion. The House file 96 being passed and re-referred to the House of the Local Government Committee. Excuse me, the Government Operations Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill passed. With that, the next bill on the agenda is Representative Holdsburg. House File 1955. Representative Bissner, would you care to hold the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 1955 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on State Government.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Representative Holdsburg. And I think everybody's getting thirsty here, so please.
I'm sure there's a party tonight, too.
What party? I just can't be getting thirsty.
Maybe I should get off the record. The bill before you, your committee today, attempts to solve a very serious problem on a short-term basis, and we hope the solution will match the length of the problem, and that Metro Transit is facing huge shortages in funds for the operating subsidy for Metro Transit, and this bill is an attempt to free up some resources from both the revolving loan fund and Livable Communities on a short-term basis to be allowed for operating subsidy for Metro Transit. Mr. Shetton is here from the council. I know he has a short handout that he'll move through rapidly to explain the bill in more detail.
Also, to the committee, Representative Mr. Shetton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetton. I'm the Urban Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. And first, I'd like to extend my apologies. My assistant was out on for death in her family, and in my haste to try to get this done, left all the materials at the House Local Government Division, correct, but everything else is in a file to make it again from our presentation last week. So my apologies for that. But I will run through this as quickly as I can. The goals of House File 1955. What we want to do is minimize the effects of the federal and state economies for those most dependent on transit while addressing our operating deficits, Representative Holbrook mentioned. We want to try to minimize service reductions, fare increases, and layoffs when our ridership is at its 27-year high. And we also want to avoid issues with the FTA regarding North Star, which we plan to open this fall, the Central Corridor, and future transit ways. A quick overview of House File 1955 is that it will allow the council to use, in calendar years 2009 through 2011, up to 75% of the livable communities account revenues collected for livable communities account programs and uncommitted balances to help balance that transit operating deficit. It will also allow the council to use up to 75% of the RELF, which is our Right-of-Way Access Loan Revolving Fund Program, those revenues, up to 75% of those revenues in the same manner. However, we won't be, we're not seeking to use the balances in that program. quick history on livable communities. It was created in 1985. In our Livable Communities demonstration account, we've had almost $87.5 million of grants to 51 communities since 1996. The TIBRA, our tax-based revitalization account, we've had $77.5 million worth of grants to 38 communities since 1996. And our LHIA, which is our local housing consensus account, we've had almost $20 million in grants to 57 communities since 1996. And my point with this is that the council is very proud of these programs. And it is with, some apprehension that we come before you actually asking for the flexibility in these programs. But we have a massive operating deficit on our transit side, and we are being asked to help ourselves. And in a economy that we have where the state is dealing with the budget deficit that you all have to deal with, we have brought forward this bill to help potentially address our situation with our state dollars. Briefly on the right-of-way acquisition revolving loan fund, it is where the council loans money to cities for the purchase of future state right-of-way when it becomes available on the open market. And this program is then repaid to the revolving loan fund when the road is built by MnDOT. And over the past 25 years, we've used this account to actually purchase right-of-way for Trunk Highway 494, Trunk Highway 212, 169, and 610. And again, this is to let you know that this is a levy and a program that we're very proud of, and it is not something that we really would like to do, but we feel that we have to take these measures in order to address our operating deficit. The sources of funding for these accounts, the Livable Communities Demonstration Account, the council levies $8.2 million a year for that program. Our REL fund, we levy $3.5 million a year. In our local housing incentives account, we transfer $1 million from our LCDA, $1 million from our council's general levy, and transfer $500,000 from the Livable Community Demonstration account. And fiscal disparities pays $5 million off the top of whatever the region collects in fiscal disparities to put into the tax-based revitalization account. As far as the utilization of these programs, between 2003 and 2006, TIBRA had requests seeking $2 for every $1 we had available for this grant. In 2008, that ratio fell to a dollar for dollar request. And additionally, this last year, $900,000 was left on the table because there weren't enough, the applications didn't meet the minimal funding criteria for that. So we have $900,000 sitting in an account that was unawarded. As far as LCDA, our demonstration account, before 2006, we had ratios of $5 to $6 available for every $1 available, and last year dropped to 2 to 1. And in 2003, there were 73 applications for this program, and in 2008, there were only 20. And another point on the utilization of the program is that just last year, 6 TIBRA, which is the Brownfield and Greenfield Cleanup Program, they relinquished $2.3 million in previously awarded grants, which had 2 years to do the project, and oftentimes we grant them an additional third year. And we had two Livable Communities Demonstration Accounts that relinquished grants of almost $1 million. These relinquished grants fund, plus the unawarded amount, left a balance of roughly $4 million in those accounts. The REL balance right now, we've got $4.3 million in that fund, with Trunk Highway 610 looking to receive federal dollars through the stimulus package. We expect a repayment of almost $2 million for grants that we made there, and we anticipate with that repayment and the $4.3 million that we have in balance, that current projects will not be affected, and it won't result in any, or this bill won't result in any immediate loss to the program. So quickly, I know everybody's in a hurry, but this is important, and I know there's a lot of people in the room who have different feelings about this, but I would just like to point out our transit deficit. Right now, we're at $62.4 million, and the use of the levies, which this bill does, out of 1955, will give us between $29 to $21 million of one-time money. If we take the full 75% of LCDA, which again leaves 25% available, would be $12.3 million. The 75% of TIBRA would give us $7.5 million, and the REL would give us $5.25 million. And then with the balance of the current, or transferring the current balances, $4 million. That is what this bill would do, you can see the numbers if you take 50%. The economic recovery projects, which is the stimulus money, allow us, or we can use up to $14 million of that money toward our operating deficit. So the last page, or the second to the last slide on the last page, the administrative interventions that we are proposing to do to address deficit, talk about administrative and service efficiencies, drawdown of reserves, that's $3 million one time. That may seem like a low number, but just from the November forecast, now the February forecast, in fiscal year 09, we have an $11 million operating deficit that we have to fix by June 30th. So we are addressing that by using $7.1 million of current reserves in order to do that. So the $3 million that we talk about for fiscal years 10 and 11 is the most that we can contribute without getting into trouble for having less reserves than are required. We also have an MBES reduction to other regional providers, which is, I'm trying to raise Mr. Chair, $7 million. A fare increase, which I know is very, very unpopular, that is the $6 million. And our bill, the way it stands right now, all this were to come to fruition, we would not have service reductions or layoffs. And the summary here is that if you allow us 75% of these levies plus the balance transfer, we would have $64 million. At 50%, we'd have $56 million. So we would still have an additional $6.4 million to make that. And the last change that we have, I just wanted to point out that we will direct $1 million of the council's LCDA account to the local housing census account. Before I mentioned that comes from the council's general levy, and by not taking that out of the general levy, it will allow us to be able to address our transit deficit further. So I know I whipped through that. I will tell you this is a very, very important bill to the council and to the administration, and it's extremely important in order to address our transit system. We look at things as a triage, and we believe that transit operating is at the top of that list, and we have to address this one way or another. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll take all the questions.
Thank you, Mr. Shetland. And we are not a policy committee, or we are a policy committee, not a finance committee. And I know it's the policy. Representative Hornstein,
here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shetland, did you discuss this proposal with cities and other stakeholders in the LCDA program? And if so, what was their reaction?
Perfect. Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, we did not sit down specifically with those folks. Part of it is because, and this bill is coming through very late, because of that. Actually, that's not true. Ms. Nauman and I sat down with back in the Rathskeller at the beginning of February and went through what our plans were for this bill and what our designs were for these money. And Ms. Nauman and I see differently on how these funds should be used. So we spent some time back in the Rathskeller talking about this, which, again, they do not support this. However, we're looking for ways to fund this. And if other people have other ideas, we can have them through the list.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that this was also brought up by Chair Bell at the State of the Region address almost a month ago, so it's not like it's a new concept and it hasn't been in the paper and presented pretty broadly by the council.
Representative Horstman.
I have one more question. Mr. Chair and Mr. Shetland, there may be seven or eight different ideas floating around there to deal with this deficit, which I think we all agree on. Dealt with very expeditiously. Why do you have only one bill? Why is one idea only in bill form? Now, what about, you've listed about five or six others. I think there's probably five or six others that legislators can come up with, but, we're looking at the finance process to, put a transit form together as we always have. Why one standalone bill?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, the reason we're here with this one bill is because it has no impact on the state's budget. And other ideas that we have, or if you wanted to consider as an additional sales tax increase or a movement of some MBES or CTIP dollars, all of those are ways that we don't support. In this one particular way, we don't support them for a variety of reasons. CTIP dollars, we use those to help operate the future operations of North Star. They're helping with the UPA project that we just passed last year that are coming online. The MVEST, you know, is constitutionally dedicated to transportation. There's a statutory 60-40 split. We're all working our way toward 2012 to see those dollars go, and the administration doesn't support that. However, this bill in particular does not have a cost to the state. Now, the city and the housing advocates would say that it's a cost to their city and to their program. Now, I'm well aware of that, and we're not up here to argue that, because we agree we would rather not be here to do that. As Chairman Bell said last week in the Senate, he supports the Livable Communities Program 100%. I mean, there's no doubt about it, but you know, tough times have us consider tough options, and as I mentioned to Ms. Melman many times, we're not happy about having to be here with this, but it also is one way to satisfy this to the tune of almost $30 million of our $62.5 million funding shortfall.
Mr. Chair, I know you're short of time, and I know this is a little unusual in that this is the policy committee, and many of the members of the policy committee here serve on transportation. We saw the committee targets with an $8 million cut in transportation. You can't just make up money in transportation. There are very few places you can go to get general fund money to fund transit, and I would hope that people would see this as maybe a very necessary tool in having some type of solution. And I would also remind people that the wording of the MVEST dedication doesn't guarantee 60% to roads. It's up to 60% for roads and no less than 40. So I don't know what, if the majority is planning, I don't know where they're planning on getting their money, but I, for one, would hate to see a solution that would take money away from roads and give it to transit. This is a viable solution for a short-term fix, and hopefully 2 years from now, development picks up, car sales pick up, and then it's all right itself again. But it's important that we have as many tools as possible in trying to write a transportation bill with the targets that have been given.
Representative Stern, if you have any questions, make it quick.
Yes, I just was wondering, the transportation, was there, and there was another bill going around to eliminate the transit district and maybe the 7-county transportation district and maybe allow opt-outs that are currently being used. Did you think of using that idea, keep transportation without using the
rule? Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sterner, you did, when you talked about the transportation transit district, that is a capital property tax levy, and that you cannot use that levy for operating. And even if we were to extend that, those dollars can be used for operating. Now, if the legislature chose to allow us to use that for operating, we still need to find the money to pay the debt service for that. And all that we finance a property tax levy is the debt service. So you'll see that the council may have $34 million worth of regional transit bonding authority. Well, all that we're actually levying for is worth is maybe $3 to $4 million of that. That's to pay the debt service for those bonds that are outstanding. So it's not a one for one. It's kind of a 1 to 5 percent, maybe even probably less than that percentage of what you can get out of there for real dollars. And I also wanted to mention, Mr. Chair, that this sunset in 2011.
Thank you. Representative Pinskins, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, just a comment after Mr. Shetland's comment that Chairman Bell does indeed support livable communities. As a person who has tried valiantly on numerous occasions to abolish the program, I can say unsuccessful but valiant, Mr. Shetland, and I can say that Chairman Bell does indeed support livable communities. And as I look at the office of the Senate file, particularly two that I've had the pleasure of serving with, Senators West and Dibble, I know that they strongly support livable communities. So I think if anyone says that this piece of legislation is an attack on livable communities, I could show them what an attack looks like. This is not it.
Thank you. We have some people who would like to speak in opposition to the bill. If you could come up all at one time. I've got Jamie Verbeauty from the City of Woodland Park, Lori Laudner from St. Paul Authority, Christian Allman from Metro Cities, Scott Tankanoff, and Gina Danik. They made it more difficult as they went down. If you give me about a minute, a minute and a half each, that'd be great.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. We represent about 85 cities in the metro area before both the legislature and the Met Council. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on this bill. I'll be very brief. Suffice it to say that we have very significant concerns with the bill before you, and we would respectfully ask that you oppose this legislation. While we do appreciate the significant challenges that the Met Council faces in funding its transit system, we believe that this legislation would set a very dangerous precedent and would endanger a program that is very financially modest and yet highly effective in helping cities to achieve important regional and community goals. We are concerned that even though this bill does sunset, once you put something like this into law, without any structural solutions to fund the transit system on the table, and that we can't foresee at this point, we would be very concerned that this would be an ongoing solution to the problem, which would effectively decimate this very important program. Particularly in a weak economy, we believe it is important not to eliminate one of what are very few resources that allow cities to continue to work on projects that will ultimately lead to jobs, business growth, economic growth, and stronger tax bases. We think to do so would be very counterproductive, and we would again ask that you oppose this legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony.
Sir, if I might, could you take a tally or poll of your member cities in order to establish this position?
Mr. Chair and members, strong support for livable communities, and, which includes strong funding for the program and flexibility in the criteria, has been a longstanding position of Metro Cities. We did a legislative alert on this proposal, and we heard back from several communities that have projects waiting in the wings that they are interested in having funding for. So, yes, we did.
We did pull what's like percentage of these things.
I don't know if she has the answer.
I don't have that specific answer. It's a position of Metro Cities. It's a formal position of Metro Cities that we do strongly support this program.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I have heard from representatives of local government when you put on the integrity of the funding for the North Star, what the feds look in approving Central Corridor, when you look at local government aid cuts, when you look at the whole realm of challenges that are being faced by local governments and funding, many of these cities see this as a very viable short-term solution because they recognize that there are other programs needed for them that are more important than this in this economy.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Jamie Herbierge? I probably be questioning your name. Welcome to the committee, and
thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jamie Herbierge. I'm the city manager in the city of Brooklyn Park. I'm going to be brief. I understand everybody's getting a little hungry, a little thirsty. The thing that I would ask the committee members to think about in terms of the effectiveness of the livable communities account is its impact on creating jobs and growing vitality in our local economies, our regional economies, and that confers a benefit to the entire state. And I'd look especially at the committee members who have served as local elected officials who understand this. By the Met Council's own estimation at the effectiveness of this program, that these dollars have leveraged billions of dollars in private sector investment that, for the most part, may not have occurred. I won't say would not have occurred. It may not have occurred. But if you look at this on a dollar for dollar, where are you spending your dollars to maximize their efficiency? By transferring this money into the transit account, okay, it's important. And I agree with Mr. Shetton, and I agree with Chairman Bell. This is a crisis, undeniable. But the benefit of using those dollars is for $1 out, you get $1 in. The benefit of using livable communities account dollars for growing private sector investment is tenfold. For every dollar that we invest, you get at least $10 of benefit. And I think that's a very conservative number. And again, these are based on Met Council's estimation of how those funds have leveraged growth in a time when we're really looking to our local communities to try and spur growth in our economies. I understand what they're trying to do. I understand that they're trying to make a choice from a list of bad choices. We're doing that in our own local economy in Brooklyn Park. We have a $2 million shortfall going into next year out of a $35 million budget. what we're going to be doing going into next year is putting together sustainable structural balance in our budget. We're not going to be relying on one-time shifts. And as a community that has benefited from livable communities in the past, I can say that this is an extremely important partnership that exists. And that partnership needs to continue in the future. And my greatest concern is that for those who may not support livable communities to the extent that many do, that this is essentially the camel's nose under the tent to never again fund livable communities, because once you take this money away, and 2 years from now, we're back in the soup, not having a structural balance in our transit operations or any other function, it's going to be extremely difficult to restore this money. And I'm done, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for tolerating.
Thank you, Mr. Kabuki. Lori Laubner, or Louder? Why are you in there? I don't know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good evening again. My name is Lori Louder, Director of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs at the St. Paul Port Authority. I'll cut to the chase, Mr. Chair. You get incredible leverage from these dollars. When we at the Port Authority and others like us undertake brownfields redevelopment, we have to cobble together funds to take these defective, distressed, and dirty sites and make them marketable for business growth. Most of our customers are small business owners. I'll give you three examples in St. Paul. At our Williams Hill site, just a quarter mile north of downtown and just two blocks from the Capitol here, you receive 19 times the dollars that you put into this project to help us out. This means $19 of private sector investment in real estate and equipment for every $1 that Met Council put in. At the Max and Steel site located in the north end in St. Paul at Como and Dale, you received 8 times the dollars that you put in as compared to the private sector money. And lastly, in the Westminster Junction area on the Phelan Quarter, just east of 35E, your return was $22 for every $1 of private sector investment. And the jobs here were massive, 925 jobs in that last example, over 500 jobs in the first two examples. Thank you so much. I appreciate your considering not passing this bill tonight.
Thank you. Scott Sackanoff. Thank you. If you could be less than a minute and a half, that would be great. I think it's more the carpet, rolling on the carpet.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Tankoff. I'm the managing partner of Hillcrest Development. I will leave, for members that are interested, a brochure, which is something that we recently put together that illustrates the progress of TBRA funding that we were able to capitalize on.
You want to do that to the pages and pass those out as you're talking?
A picture does say 1,000 words. All I do is commercial redevelopment. The majority of the buildings that I purchase, they look like a bomb went off of them. I'm not a public sector person. I go and buy things that are polluted, dysfunctional, empty, there's no jobs in them, there's tremendous blight. What I can say, and it's almost like I'm biting the hand that feeds me by speaking at this opposing that council. The TBRA funding is huge. Without the TBRA funding, the project that's being illustrated, Crown Center, never could have happened. Many of the other projects that are coming at this point, not only the city of Minneapolis, but other communities, will not happen but for this program. It is the one program that addresses asbestos and lead abatement in any fashion. There's no federal program that I'm aware of. It's really simple. This is about leveraging. I think the comments before were really good about leveraging dollars. It's a tough time. It takes a lot of courage to stand up and talk about what needs funding. This is a program that needs to be funded. The leveraging is huge. The results are huge. I count all the jobs that we create in our developments. Over the last 10 years, we've created and housed into most of our projects in Minneapolis several thousand living wage, above living wage jobs in the city of Minneapolis. So this is about good jobs, good communities. This program needs to be kept. In closing, it's about increased tax base as well. In my properties, we've seen not only a tenfold, but in some cases, a 20-fold increase in real estate taxes that are being paid by our project.
And the more important point would be it's about the surrounding communities. This program touches areas that Candy Lee will not get dealt with otherwise. And again, I just implore, don't let this program go.
Thank you. Sheena? Not going to attempt. Sagannick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Gina Sagannick. I represent the nonprofit housing development sector. I work for a company called Aon. I ditto everything that has been previously said, so cut to the chase.
You can just cut to you.
Yes. So what I wanted to talk about is think about healthy communities and what we all need as human beings to survive. Air, water, food, housing is not far from that. And although the transportation is also something important for our community, taking away that housing that they need for shelter is not a great way to figure out how to fund the transit bill. I, too, think my council is a good partner. We've been using their funds for many years on our affordable housing developments. It ranges from about $100,000 to near $1 million. So that is hard to replace. I would quickly say on the utilization, although something I'm not going to worry about tonight or at all, but I think that's only because the eligibility requirements have gotten overly restrictive. So I know all of it could really be used if there was a little more flexibility. I appreciate the struggle. Again, I understand you can't keep the blood from a turnip. But when Mr. Shetland mentioned the apprehension, even bringing this forward, I think that is a very strong indication that this is not a great way to resolve an issue. So please find another source that can secure both housing and transportation to serve our community. Thank you.
Do you want to close up?
I think what the committee has to know is that he has $8 million in brownfield money. The stimulus package has $100 million of money that was similar to the TIBRA account. And so there's other sources that can fund these type of projects as well. And so we have flexibility in that area that we never had before. And if you look at the slides, you can see how much has been sent back in that's not been used, how the applications have drastically fallen off. In our situation, our housing market right now, there are plenty of low-income housing opportunities available, and maybe this wouldn't be the time to be building new stuff. Maybe we should take care of what we already have. So certainly a tool that I'm sure the Transportation Committee would appreciate having available to them as they're trying to meet their target.
And in my Representative Holbrook, I'm going to leave. Representative Horst.
Oh, no. It sounds like you're going to do what I would suggest, which is the latest, over. This is not ready
And with that in mind, that's what it is. I'm going to lay this over for right now. We're afraid if we voted on it, it would kill us, and I think we want to preserve the ability to possibly use it. Like you said, like was said by the testament, we're faced with a lot of bad choices in the next year. And where I would not want to use this as a choice, we may be forced to do it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for it. And Representative Stewart, do you want to move the minutes for the March 23rd?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I've reviewed the minutes and looked very exquisite. Ms. Redford, our excellent job in these minutes.
The minutes have been moved. All in favor of the minutes for March 23rd, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It's passed. The meeting is over. He's adjourned.